Next study is Nehemiah, chapter 9, beginning with the first verse. Let us read two verses, Sister Carol and then Sister Dorothy.
Now in the 24th day of this month, the children of Israel were assembled with fasting and with sackcloth and earth upon them, and the seed of Israel separated themselves from all strangers and stood and confessed their sins and the iniquities of their fathers.
All right. Let us consider the first verse, which speaks that this assembly that took place in the days of Nehemiah, in connection with this particular event we've been studying, which is in the 8th chapter, that on the 24th of the 7th month, that they were assembled and with fasting and sackcloth and prayer. Any comment as regards the time, etc.?
Well, this was following the Feast of Tabernacles, so they were already prepared mentally leading into this 24th
day. All right. In other words, this was really the Feast of Tabernacles, started to introduce this period of time, but the 8th day was to be a solemnity, a solemn occasion. And here it's speaking about this particular last day that was appended to this feast. Now, and earth upon them. So it was like like sackcloth and ashes, or dust, or dirt, whatever was convenient. This was a symbol of humbling themselves. And today, we're not that demonstrative as a people. We don't do these things today, but and probably, you know, with this modern culture that we live under, we probably think that's rather strange to see such behavior. And probably, I'm speaking, this is what the ordinary public might think, would think that it's too ceremonial and so forth, but but if it's done with spirit and feeling, I think it's a very good sign. And, of course, the situation back there, as far as where the room was, you're not in the meeting hall with a nice wooden floor, tile floor, or whatever. You're out in the open. Now, in verse 2, it says the seed of Israel, that they separated themselves from the strangers. Comment on that.
Probably who married the foreign Canaanites.
All right, the strangers that were in that area, in the environs of Israel, adjoining Jerusalem, etc. But you'll notice that in the early days of Ezra, that he had given counsel that they were to put aside their wives and children that were born, that who were strangers. And they, from back the account back there, they evidently complied. But this intimates that they fell back into that situation again, the second time. And let us say roughly about 20 years later, this is a change that took place. That after Esther's counsel, Ezra's counsel. which suggests the possibility also that these strangers, which were adjoined to particularly the males of Israel, were perhaps either new wives or the wives that had been put aside before and brought back again. In any event, it showed that the good start that they had made at the time of Ezra, that there was this the setting in again of the same situation at the time of Nehemiah. And so Nehemiah's influence was along the same lines as Ezra. And by example of the events, I think, inspired them more, where Ezra, through, I can't say sheer personality, but somewhat along that line, the spiritual, the holy charisma of Ezra and the power that he told them to do this, set aside their wives, greatly influenced them so that they obeyed. Now, at the time of Nehemiah, they obeyed through, I think, the surrounding providences of the Lord, where the temple had been completed and the walls of the city had been now redone, and they were beginning now to settle into their own residences, and that they saw in this that this perhaps had an influence on them, and they were reminded without doubt of what Ezra had previously done. And so it says they separated themselves, so it showed that they had joined themselves earlier.
Brother Frank?
Yes.
In Ezra, it speaks of, and they made an end with, this is from Ezra, the 10th chapter, and they made an end with all men that had taken strange wives by the first day of the first month. Oh, the first month, we're in the seventh month. Well, they left.
Yeah, this is another year, though.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
See, Ezra now is a very old man. He died, in, I think, must be very shortly here, either just before or just after. Because it was in the 20th year of Artaxerxes was when Nehemiah came on the scene, where Ezra came on the scene in the 7th year of Artaxerxes, 13 years before Nehemiah. Nehemiah came 13 years after Ezra, but this is not 13 years later here. This is a little longer.
Oh, well, they did that sometime then.
Because we had read that he's making preparations to return after a 12-year leave of absence, which would be after, let us say, just for convenience sake, the 20th year of Artaxerxes. In other words, in the 33rd year of Artaxerxes you're speaking about here. I'm using that just as a little fix. All right, now, the next point in verse 2, the second half of the verse, and stood and confessed their sins and the iniquities of their fathers. Now, let us say that the first three verses of this chapter are like, sometimes at the, like taking the volumes. When you read the volumes, the restoration of Israel, the kingdoms of this world, times of restitution, whatever, usually at the beginning of the chapter, in very fine print, you have a little, like, sort of almost in italics, telling you what's in the chapter, the study you're about to proceed. Study 9, such and such a study. But in this preview, you have what's being covered by this chapter. And so we feel that this, the first part of this chapter, is talking about the events of the day. But then it goes into the detail, the detail of the day, where the other is like a synopsis. they stood and confessed their sins and iniquities of their fathers. So they had to acknowledge what had happened. Now, notice that this is the 24th day. What had happened in the previous days? They had all this reading of the law, and the people, they wept because this was so new to them. The word of God had evidently had faded from their memory. They couldn't worship as freely in Babylon and with their synagogues and so forth as conveniently and the law was found by Ezra. Ezra found the law in the library, one of the branches of the library under the Persian Empire. He discovered it and then codified it and brought it to the attention of the people. And this was long after Cyrus's decree. Cyrus' decree was in 536 B.C., and this about Ezra, you're getting now into the 400 years B.C., like 82 years later or so, that Ezra has now brought the word of God out of the storehouse where it was preserved providentially. And the people, it was new to them. So they had an education prior to this particular day. The 24th day was preceded by being made acquainted with parts of the law, and it continues. This is the last day, but they're still reading. Let us read verses 3 and 4. Next, please.
And they stood up in their place and read in the book of the law of the Lord their God 1/4 part of the day, and another 1/4 part they confessed and worshiped the Lord their God, then stood up upon the stairs of the Levites, Jeshua and Benai, Kadmiel, Shebaniah, Bunai, Sherebiah, Benai, and Shenanai, and cried with a loud voice unto the Lord their God.
All right. So when you take a 1/4 part of the day, that's 6 hours, right? 1/4 of 24 is 6 hours. And then there's another 1/4 part of the day. In other words, 6 hours plus 6 hours is 12 hours. This is the daylight period. So all during the day, while there was still daylight, where they could read the law and pray conveniently, there was activity going on with regard to being further familiarity with the Word of God and the Lord's commands, plus a prayer session, that this is like a 12-hour meeting. This is like for 12 hours.
From sunrise to sunset.
All right. And then you can be sure there was no meal time. No coffee breaks.
Because they were fasting.
Yeah, there was one particular period. And verse 4, it mentions this, let's call it Levitical stand, or grandstand, or, you know, like stage area, that 8 personalities of the Levites stood up to instruct the people in a generalized sense, maybe giving the subject matter, and then other Levites down among the people do other things as far as further acquainting those that had difficulty in understanding. And it mentions their voice. They cried with a loud voice unto the Lord their God. So there was like a very an emotional prayer given by these. to create the proper mood of reverence and attentiveness as to what be done. And it's interesting that in the next verse, well, we haven't read that, have we?
No.
No. Let us read 5 and 6, please.
And the Levites, Jeshua, Kadmiel, Benai, Hashbaniah, Sherebiah, Hojiah, Shebaniah, and Hephaniah said, stand up and bless the Lord your God forever and ever. Blessed be your glorious name, which is exalted above all blessings and praise.
Right. Was there be another verse?
Well, it's a paragraph break that you would add another one.
Notice the names are repeated a second time. And I would say probably, just glancing at it, that I'm not making a definite comparison, but most of the names are the same. The ones that may differ may be another way of mentioning their surname from another standpoint. Maybe, you know, in the captivity, everybody had especially in the leadership, had at least two names. Remember the three Hebrew children?
Mm-hmm.
It told what their names were in Hebrew and then in the Babylonian. And Daniel, he had a name in the Hebrew and in the Babylonian language. So we would say that these personalities that are involved back in Babylon had dual names. And it's interesting, some of them kept the name that they had. They tagged along with them when they went into return to the homeland. And something could happen, too, with regard to them, that there had to be some relief or an alternate was inserted. So we cannot expect that this has to be exactly alike. But what is very interesting is that all these details are put here as though it's for future reference. At some future time, this will be important. But it's not important to us. Are these names that important to us? Well, we haven't even, I don't know if there's anybody qualified to know too much about an analysis of each name here and who they were and their background. There's such a paucity of information. Some of them you there's information, but I don't think that's the particular point. So when you see this being specifically so stated, it seems to suggest this is for future reference by somebody at some time. Has an importance. Yes.
Could it be, of course, they're descendants now. They're longing to know who they came from, that they might be given the same position in the future when the temple is singing and so forth and different avenues.
Well, that's one suggestion. It can be. I mean, I certainly don't know, but it can be something along there's a reason for it. That's what it boils down to. And as far as knowing as a tenth son in lineage from these, you wouldn't even know which one of these, if it happened to be one of your ancestors, you wouldn't know of it because of the breakage in of the lineage after AD 70. See, that was they were separated from their families. They died. They were put into captivity. They were sold separately. Husband separate from wife to one, a wife to another. They lost their not their Jewishness, but they did lose some of their heritage. The knowledge was, and so we do not have. It cannot be proven. The Cohens and the Zadoks and so forth today, whether they are valid or not, until this is made clear in the Kingdom Age.
Well, their earnestness is certainly admirable. I mean, they just followed 7 days of reading from the law each day, and now they're still in the proper heart condition, sustained. So it would seem that there might be some honor singled out for them in the future.
Let us read verse 6 and 7. Next, please.
Thou, even thou, art Lord alone. Thou hast made heaven, the heaven of heavens, with all their host, the earth, and all things that are therein, the seas and all that is therein, and thou preservest them all. And the host of heaven worshipeth thee. Thou art the Lord, the God who didst choose Abram, and broughtest him forth out of Ur of the Chaldees, and gave him the name of Abraham.
All right, now we go back to verse 6, where this is like a congregational response. And, this was the response of the 8 people on the stand.
The Revised says Ezra said this, but there's also a footnote saying GK, Greek is that? But this is in Greek. Does GK colon, Hebrew left, and Ezra said? The Revised did insert it.
Yeah, well, they inserted it, and that I would.
What does GK stand for? Do you know?
No,
I don't. Where it is down here? GK colon.
Well, that's Greek. Greek.
Is that like the Septuagint?
The Greek, that'd be the Septuagint. The Septuagint is the one.
So this, okay.
Notice it says that acknowledgement is made that Jehovah is the Creator, which we have discussed in previous studies. And thou art Jehovah alone. That is, this is a peculiar, a specific attribute that God possesses. He is the Creator. That this is a signal attribute that he possesses as Creator of all these things. And it's interesting they go into the detail about the heavens and the earth, and even the fish and the sea. I mean, that they mention it. It's like under the Holy Spirit, sort of an inspirational outburst of enthusiasm. Now, thou art the Jehovah, the God, who did choose Abram. You notice it doesn't say Abraham here. It gives his old name. When he was in Ur of Chaldees, before he inherited the new name. Which is recorded roughly, I think, was it Genesis 15 chapter or so? Who did choose Abraham and broughtest him forth out of Ur of the Chaldees and gavest him the name of Abraham. Now, why is this mentioned? Because they see a similarity. Just as Abraham came out of Ur of Chaldees into the land of promise, so they came out of Babylon, a foreign land, into the promised land. So this is a natural analogy that they're saying that thou art not only the God that brought Israel out of Egypt and brought Abraham and those that were with him out of Ur of Chaldees, but you have brought us out into this situation we now find ourselves possessing, and we are praising thee for this circumstance in our lives. Let us read 8 and 9.
And foundest his heart faithful before thee, and madest a covenant with him, to give the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, and the Perizzites, and the Jebusites, and the Girgashites, to give it, I say, to his seed, and hast performed thy word, for thou art righteous, and didst see the affliction of our fathers in Egypt, and heardest their cry by the Red Sea.
Right. Now, of course, this with the Canaanites in the land is quite a bit beforehand. This is way, way down the road in history from the seven nations that were mentioned earlier in the days of Joshua. When he entered the land, there were the seven foreign nations that had to be expelled. Then in another period of history, it mentions six. In this one, it mentions, was it five?
Six.
It mentions six here. In some places, it dwindles because of other things that have happened in the intervening time. And has performed thy words. Now, the thing is this. When God promised to give to the land to Abraham, and then they had all these experiences, and then you had the period of the coming from Egypt, and then there was the dividing of the land, and then there was the history of the judges and of the kings of Israel, and how they were, all the experiences they went through of various captivities under the judges, and under the kings, they finally, the city was destroyed, the temple was destroyed, and they're put into Babylon. But God did not forget them in Babylon, as Moses said he wouldn't, in Leviticus. And now they find that they have had this experience, and that it's the covenant-keeping God who gave a covenant to Abraham, and we as Abraham's people can testify that now we're back in our land again, and that God in his mercy has done this work on our behalf. That's about the substance of the feelings that they had at this time. And that they had affliction. Just as in Egypt, it was called the furnace of affliction. It was called the house of bondage. So in Babylon, they had friction there. They did have houses, they did have some other things, but they had curbs, which they acutely felt, because the Jewish nation, under their training, under the Hebrew law, were like independent spirits. They were different than other subjugated people who had been for, say, a couple thousand years under captivity. They don't have aspirations of liberty. They're so it's been so inborn into them, and it's only in our day that some of these people that have been oppressed for thousands of years, that knowledge is coming to them, filtering out throughout the earth, so that their hopes are rising. But the Jews were very high-spirited. And they felt acutely the bondage in Babylon. That is, the ones who wanted to serve God acceptably, as of old, they found that in the climate in Babylon, it was not conducive to that. And so those that had that spirit, that like Abraham had. No, Abraham took up all his baggage and left Ur of Chaldees. And he was a wealthy man. Abraham was a wealthy man before he left Ur of Chaldees. It's true that he brought out a lot of things with him, a lot of animals, servants. He had a lot of servants. But he pulled up stakes from a place where he had, very much like in Babylon, a land rich in fertility, in comforts and so forth, but filled with idolatry. And so there are traditions about Abraham in Ur of Chaldee, and traditions about his father, whose name was
Terah,
that in Babylon, where they felt very discomforted along religious lines. This is the thing. It was along religious lines that it was unbearable. And so when God told Abraham to leave his land and go to some place that he's going to show me, he didn't tell him too much about it. Abraham was, his conditioning was such, he was ready to obey, and he did. And so when they were in Babylon, the ones that returned when Cyrus gave the decree, and at the time of Ezra, there was another coming out of Babylon in the days of Ezra. The first one was under the stewardship or leadership of Zerubbabel and Joshua. They were the two principal ones at the time of Cyrus's decree. Then when Ezra came along, some came with him. But these were people who were discomforted with the idolatry that existed. It's like with the Christian being called out of Babylon. Come out of Babylon, my people. Well, the people who are in Babylon, some of them are, they don't like some of the things that go on in Babylon. But they cannot break the ties. They cannot break family ties, friendship ties, and go to where the Lord might lead. And so when the call came to come out of Babylon in 1878, not everybody came out of Babylon. Come out of Babylon, my people. That is the one. So we have analogies here that this is the class that the Lord looks to who have come out in various stages of development according to his bidding and providence and leading. Thou foundest his heart faithful before thee, and then made this covenant to give him the land occupied by these different people. Let us read verses 10 and 11. Next.
And shewed signs and wonders upon Pharaoh, and on all his servants, and on all the people of the land, for thou knewest that they dealt proudly against them. So didst thou get thee a name, as it is this day. And thou didst divide the sea before them, so that they went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and their persecutors thou threwest into the deep, as a stone into the mighty waters.
Right. Now these show what the Lord did to their enemies. When they came out of Babylon, Belshazzar, remember it says that the very night he died, remember the handwriting on the wall, the invading army entered in the dry riverbed underneath the walls of Babylon and captured the city. And Belshazzar, the night that Babylon had shown him the writing on the wall, thou art found wanting, etc., that he perished. The enemy was dealt with, and Pharaoh died in the Dead Sea. Now, at the time when Ezra came out, there must have been some providence that was surely shown to him, but it was not along that line. It was not as marked as it was at the time of Cyrus. They probably were reacquainted with the book of Exodus, because they were not familiar with their heritage. So with all this reading, let's say 6 hours a day, you can be sure they covered the Pentateuch. You can be sure they read the whole book of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. I mean, you're talking about
without food.
Yeah. So they got, and probably that was a very unusual circumstance that the Lord, these people that were chosen to read, they probably read very clearly on that occasion. That would be providential.
Oh,
Because look what would be lost. They had to be providentially selected that they would enunciate with power in their voice so that the people could hear and understand, because there was no microphones. There was no louds, you know, in the normal sense. There's a possibility they used, like the coxswain used, you know, this, what do you call
megaphone.
It?
Megaphone.
What do you call it?
Megaphone.
Megaphone, or, but where you put your, you know, voice in and there's a fan shape thing. That goes back into very ancient history and was not only used in the rowing and the regatta or in the race, but that type of amplification of voice was known. And the most ancient one is the one that was shown at the World Fair in New York City many years ago by the telephone company. And the telephone company, to show the advance that historically has been made by the telephone, they start out with this picture of a forest. And there's a man there. He's in desperate straits. He doesn't know where he is, and so he puts his hands to his mouth, see, two hands, and he shouts. And then they record that film of him shouting, and they show that as you recede, it gets fainter and fainter, and 100 yards away or so, you don't know what he's saying. It got fainter and fainter and fainter, and they're showing that's as far as the human voice could go. Not too long ago. That just as... when you shouted, that was the limit. And if you're beyond that range, you're out of luck. Now, you can talk with a normal voice and be heard around the world. You could be heard around the world. Chiefly lately, the last decade, because of the satellites, which take up and like transformers, as it were, strengthen the voice so that it goes to the next satellite and then down to the country, the people that is supposed to be directed to. But things have come a long way. And that was an ad of the telephone company, and I thought that was very impressive when I saw that. How it brought out acutely how 100 years before, this is the condition that existed for thousands of years. This condition. Where you put your hands to your mouth and shouted if you wanted to be heard. Now it's a telephone. First it started with a... was a Morse code or something?
Mm-hmm. You know, telegraph.
Telegraph and so forth. Now back to the account. So you could see that this occasion in history, when it is shown in the future, it'll be marvelous. And to see and to, as it were, be there and see how this thing happened. Twelve and 13, please.
By a pillar of cloud thou didst lead them in the day, and by a pillar of fire in the night to light for them the way in which they should go. This is the Revised. Thou didst come down upon Mount Sinai and speak with them from heaven and give them right ordinances and true laws, good statutes and commandments.
All right. So they were familiar, and this is like a capping of the events of the preceding week. This is like a, what do you call it, like a summarization. Sometimes, like in a convention, they used to have a service where the chairman, at the end of the program, would sum up the talks of the day. Spending maybe 30 seconds on each talk, what the topic was, what it was along the line, and then the next one, as like a refresher. That used to be done when I first came in the truth fairly frequently, that type of a program, to remind what had happened during the day. But this is like the eighth day, telling about the preceding week when they were made familiar with all these things. And these are mentioned in only a few verses. But when you go back and read this account, why, you have to read a couple chapters. You know, the crossing of the Red Sea and all that, about the storms and so forth. But this is a summarization. And incidentally, when you read or study about the Exodus, you find that the enthusiasm that existed, that it seemed to be particularly David, was very much impressed by Moses' account of the crossing of the Red Sea. And then that's David, which is quite a bit later. That's about like 500 years later. Then the next thing you know, it's way down in Nehemiah's day, this is brought up again. And evidently, this was done under the coaching of either Ezra or Nehemiah, that this enthusiasm for the crossing of the Red Sea is revived. Today, it's nothing. I mean, that's like a fairy tale. People are not there. And they like to go to it. They go and see the Exodus and the Ten Commandments, and it's very exciting to the public. But it's like seeing a football game or a movie or something else. It means that for while they're viewing it, they're interested and elevated for a short time, and then they go back and live their regular lives. But now other people react differently. They are impressed, and they carry that with them for years, the seed plots and so forth. And that's the use of memory, that the value that it has if God grants us that capability, that it can be a blessing. Now, this accounting of being led by the pillar of fire, that's mentioned in the Old Testament, so they had been familiar with that. And the coming down on the Sinai, how awesome that was on the third day. And then the reading of the law, and then Moses' elaboration of the, as it were, the Ten Commandments into various details that are involved, that are and the ceremonies and so forth under the law. They had gone through that the previous days. And these are now telling their appreciation of that. Let us read two more verses, please. What's that, 14, is it?
Yeah.
15? All right.
And madest known unto them thy holy Sabbath, and the command, and commandest them precepts, statutes, and laws by the hand of Moses thy servant, and gavest them bread from heaven for their hunger, and broughtest forth water for them out of the rock for their thirst, and promised them that they should go in and in to possess the land which thou hast sworn to give them.
All right. And so it goes into the details about the echelon of the Sabbath and these various statutes, and then how miraculously they were fed with manna and the quail, that isn't mentioned here, and the water from the rock and such things. God did miracles on their behalf. Now, we'll have to stop here because we cannot continue through the end of this. It would take too long a study based on what had previously happened earlier with the business discussion. And we'll have to end here, but then it goes into a negative aspect of when the nation began to digress and deviate from God's statutes and laws. Their appreciation waned. And then it showed, it gives a knowledge of what their fathers had done. And they themselves in their personal lives. So we'll close here at this juncture.